Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
And good morning. This is Focus 580, the second hour of the program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. Well, late last year, I'm sure that you will know because it's gotten a lot of coverage, late last year it was reported by the New York Times that President Bush had authorized the National Security Agency to conduct surveillance of telephone and internet traffic into and out of the United States. The action by the president has widely been criticized as a violation of the law and led to a number of questions about balancing the need for intelligence with the right to privacy. So this morning, in this part of the program, we'll talk a little bit about this controversy and about domestic spying and the history of counterterrorism. And our guest for this part of Focus 580 is Timothy Naftali. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia. He's Director of the Presidential Recordings Program and the Kremlin Decision-Making Project. His research focuses on Soviet Union and the Cold War, the history of intelligence in Europe and America, as well as the presidency of John F. Kennedy and World War II and Nazi war crimes. He was trained as an historian. He's written political histories on the Cold War, on the Second World War, and also on espionage, before coming to the Miller Center, where he is now at University of Virginia. He was visiting assistant professor at Yale, where he taught courses on intelligence, on international relations, and the Cold War in the Third World. Let me tell you just about these couple of things that he is involved with, because I think that they're quite interesting. He directs the Miller Center Presidential Recordings Program, where he oversees a team of scholars and staff that are responsible for transcribing many, many hours of phone conversations and meetings that were secretly recorded in the White House by Presidents Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon. He also directs the Kremlin Decision-Making Project, that is in partnership with the Federal Archival Service of Russia. He and the other folks there at University of Virginia are translating, editing, and publishing the international edition of the most secret materials of the Khrushchev era. He is also author of the book, and because I want to mention it because it deals pretty specifically with what it is here we're talking this morning, a book entitled Blind Spot, The Secret History of American Counterterrorism. It's a book that was published by Basic Books and came out, I believe, just last year. So if you're interested in the subject, you can take a look at the book. Questions are certainly welcome, as always, here on the program. If you'd like to be a part of the conversation, you can give us a call. The number here is 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana. If it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Professor Naftali, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Very well, thank you.
Thank you for talking about this. Even though the issue of the NSA and spying has gotten a lot of attention, been much discussed over the last couple of months, I don't want to take it for granted that everyone listening to us is up to speed on this. So maybe it would be a good idea just to start with a very, very basic question and ask about what this controversy is about and what it is that the president has done, apparently, that concerns so many people, not just civil libertarians, but also people in the Congress, and not just Democrats in the Congress, Republicans as well.
Well, let's just step back a minute and review a very important era in our history. In the 1970s, there was a settlement, a political settlement between the Congress and the White House, whereby presidents promised, or at least the Congress demanded the president's promise, that that they not undertake any domestic surveillance of intelligence targets without the involvement of the judicial branch, that there had to be a special warrant There had to be a warrant from a court for the White House to initiate any domestic surveillance. Now, why did this happen? It happened because in the 70s, revelations emerged of abuses, domestic abuses by the CIA and the FBI in their pursuit of communist slash Soviet agents. The FBI, there's a very fine line between extremism, which is illegal, and dissent, which is legitimate in our society. And the FBI blurred that line and began to wiretap anti-war movement, members of the anti-war movement, and they wiretapped civil rights leaders. Meanwhile, the CIA, which is not supposed to operate in the United States, was operating in the United States. And the CIA, again, under the instructions of the president, these were not rogue elephants, but the U.S. intelligence community was opening U.S. mail. The National Security Agency, that's the group that breaks codes and intercepts foreign and domestic signals, the National Security Agency had established a relationship with American cable and telegraph companies so that the U.S. government could read all the telegrams, the email of the day, if you will, that Americans were sending abroad and receiving from abroad. All of this activity was illegal and unconstitutional, and it was part of our fight against the Soviet menace. Well, when this became known in the 70s, which, as some might remember, was a time of Watergate and a time of Vietnam, Congress said enough is enough and set up a series of laws and institutions to prevent this kind of abuse by the U.S. intelligence community. The institutions involved an oversight committee, both in the Senate and in the House, and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, a court that is open 24 hours a day in Washington. It's a secret court. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court selects the members of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and this court is there only to provide warrants to the FBI or to the National Security Agency, which would allow them to go after bad people. Now, this was, in a sense, it was our way as Americans of trying to balance security and privacy. The Bush administration, when the New York Times came out with a revelation in December of last year that the White House had undertaken a program of warrantless surveillance, to a lot of people it was a red flag because this was a violation of the settlement that was reached in the 1970s. Now, what has to be taken into consideration is that there are a number of people in the Bush administration, for example, the Vice President, Dick Cheney, who were around in the 1970s, and they never accepted the settlement. They never believed that the White House had to listen to Congress on the matter of privacy in this matter. In fact, they believed that the Constitution, the Article 2 of the Constitution, which, by the way, if you look at it, is very general. It just sets up and establishes the office of the president and the president. They believe that that Article 2 alone gives the president the right to do whatever he or she feels is necessary to defend national security. Period. And that's why this was for many people a touchstone issue. It's not so much a Democrat versus Republican issue, because if you look carefully at the lines that are being drawn, there are many Republicans, very prominent Republicans, Chuck Hagel, John McCain, Lindsey Graham, who are actually very, very, very upset about what the White House has done. There are some Democrats like Joe Lieberman who are less upset. So this is not a Democrat versus Republican issue. This is a question of separation of powers and what role Congress should play and whether the President of the United States can spy at will in the United States.
Hmm. Let me ask you one further question. We can get into some of these things in some greater detail. But it's very clear that in response to this charge that what they have done is illegal, that this warrantless surveillance was illegal. The Bush administration is very clear they're taking kind of two tacks. One is that they're saying, as far as they were concerned, what they did was legal because it was authorized in a kind of a blanket authorization from the Congress to the administration to do whatever it takes to battle terror. And it's sort of their argument going back to previous administrations
that says that in wartime,
the president can pretty much do whatever he wants to defend the United States. And the other thing the administration has done is it has said, not so much to members of Congress, but it seems to be saying to the American people, saying, our prime concern is to keep Americans safe from terrorism. Everything we do is designed to do that, and that puts them in the position to say, well, if you criticize what we do, obviously you're not concerned about terrorism.
It's a double standard, really, because in a sense, the administration is saying we know what's best for you, and if you don't agree, then you are unpatriotic. But, you know, in our system, we don't just have one branch of government. We have three branches of government. And to be patriotic to the United States is to be patriotic to the Constitution. The Constitution created a Congress and a judiciary as well as an executive branch. But it's the executive branch that's saying, listen, we are the principal branch when America is at war. So listen to us. That argument is an argument that reasonable people can accept, or I would accept, for the first few days after an enemy attacks. You know, in the first few days after an enemy attacks, in the initial moments of an attack, really our executive branch and our military are the best suited to deal with an emergency. I understand perfectly that there isn't enough time to put together legal briefs, perhaps to get warrants. That's why, for example, Katrina was such a mystery to me, since I study counterterrorism. The federal government is the most capable organization to deal with a mass urban challenge like Katrina, and yet the Bush administration didn't do anything of value for a number of days. But reasonable people would agree that the federal government, particularly the executive branch, should step in. What is worrisome, I think, is that after the first few months of a program like this, our constitutional system has to get back in balance. This war on Islamic extremism is not going to go away. It's not going to stop tomorrow. In fact, it's going to have a ragged end. Osama bin Laden apparently... there's apparently this interview with him, which is a continuation of an interview that Al Jazeera posted not too long ago, wherein he says, "You're not going to get me alive. You know, if you're going to get me, I'm going to kill myself, or I'll be found dead." Well, does the war end when we find Osama bin Laden dead? No, it's not going to end that way. So, how long are we going to have emergency measures? My concern is that we will have to have them a long time. Well, they need to be compatible with our constitutional system. Otherwise, there's going to be a corrosive effect on privacy and liberty. It's not sustainable for the executive branch to say that it knows it all. And what's been very, very heartening is in the last couple of weeks, significant senior congressional figures have demanded, not just Democrats, Republicans too, have demanded that the administration explain what it is that it's doing with this warrantless surveillance program and why it cannot be made fully legal and constitutional. I know there's a debate over whether it's constitutional or not, but it's a real debate, and there are many very, very reasonable, nonpartisan folks who believe that the administration's arguments are hokum. And I would have to say, if you look carefully at the administration's arguments, they've shifted. Initially, people were saying Article 2 of the Constitution was enough. Then when they realized that even Republicans didn't accept that view, then they began to say that what Congress voted on in the days after September 11th was a blanket, if you will, a blank check to allow the administration to do what it wanted. Well, that's not working either, because Republicans who voted for that realized, no. We weren't letting the administration do anything, certainly not to spy at home. So I think that the administration is finding that it needs some kind of legal framework to continue this operation.
The question of the constitutionality obviously would have to be ruled on by the Supreme Court. Do you think it likely that the court get involved in this, or is this something that can be worked out between the executive and between the administration and the Congress?
Well, the best outcome for us as Americans would be for the Congress and the administration to work it out. I say this as somebody who wants the U.S. government to do everything it can to defeat terrorism, but I want it done in a way that we can be proud of as Americans. In World War II, President Roosevelt rounded up 110,000 Japanese Americans, 70,000 of whom were born in the United States. This was an act that in retrospect we are not proud of at all. This is what happens when you have unchecked federal power. It's not a matter of George Bush being a good or bad president. It's that we've learned throughout American history that unchecked power is a bad thing, no matter who has it, Roosevelt or Bush.
We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation, and probably I should introduce again our guest for anyone who's tuned in the last 5 minutes or so. We're talking with Timothy Naftali. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia. And as an historian, he's interested in political history of the Cold War, World War II, and espionage. And he is the author of a book entitled Blind Spot, The Secret History of American Counterterrorism, published by Basic Books. And that book came out last year, 2005. Questions welcome. We have several ready to go, starting with someone over in Indiana on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Extremely germane. I certainly agree with the thing about the unchecked power. What concerns me about this particular administration is what use they would put those intercepts to. I could see them using them politically. You know, I just don't trust these boys at all. They are very cagey. And the way Washington worked, they knew what the hell they were going to get into. And they seemed to think that the best way to do anything is just go ahead and do it and worry about what happens later on, whatever it might have happened to do with the three parts of the government. I wonder if you could make a comment about that, if it's germane at all. I just don't trust these guys at all. Thanks.
Well, thank you for your good question, sir. The ACLU has launched a suit against the government, and some of the participants include James Bamford, who wrote two very fine books, Histories of the National Security Agency. And Bamford's argument in participating in the suit is not that he has evidence that the administration is going after protesters, but he fears that this might be the case. Of course, everyone's great concern is that this operation might be used for political purposes. We have to make clear to the listeners that we don't know for sure what this operation is. I've written a few pieces in Slate with a colleague, Shane Harris, and there were people that there's evidence that this operation may be much larger than the administration heretofore has admitted to. We just don't know, and that's why both Shane and I were making the argument that we don't need to know. We don't need to know because there need to be secrets in wartime, but Congress needs to know. There are lots of people who could be neutral observers, who could actually think about this information. We could even have the Supreme Court look at it and discover the extent to which this operation is as narrowly focused as the administration says. Right now, the administration gives you the impression that all they're doing is listening to conversations, one side of which is foreign, involving people who have a link to Al-Qaeda or its affiliates, and that this is a small number of calls. That's what the administration has said. That's its position. That's what President Bush said in the State of the Union address. But there are indications that there's much more going on. Now, I don't know if it's pointed at domestic dissent. As I said, there's this ACLU case, which we'll get into that. I don't know, but I do have an inkling that this is much broader than the narrowly focused operation that the administration says, and I do believe that Congress has an obligation to represent us. They have the clearances. They can see top secret and top secret plus information. It's their they have the obligation to investigate this on our behalf. The other thing about trusting, well, I'll put it to you this way. My specialty is studying the history of intelligence, and I've studied a lot of administrations, and I've looked at CIA materials, declassified materials. This administration has a very, very low credibility when it talks about intelligence. This is the administration that gave us one explanation for going into Iraq, which is based on intelligence, and now that it admits the intelligence was faulty, says that the rationale was good anyway. What I take from that, the takeaway for me, is it doesn't really matter what the intelligence says. Our policy is always going to be right. So I do have many questions. When the administration says something, that intelligence is pushing for something, that we have good intelligence, that something has produced good intelligence, I'm afraid I'm a skeptic, and I'm a skeptic for good reason. The balance sheet is not in the administration's favor on intelligence.
We have other callers. Let's come back here to Urbana for others, and next go to someone on line number one, right here. Hello.
Oh, hello. How are you?
Good.
Last summer, my friend's brother-in-law works for the CIA, and he's an Arab language specialist, and he was in eastern Afghanistan along the Pakistani border after the early part of the war, going through the caves and, you know, translating documents or collecting and translating documents. And he told, I had a chance to talk to him last summer when I was out at the East Coast, and he told me that these people are frightening, to say the least. I mean, Al-Qaeda and their objectives. And I understand the ideals of this country and, let's say, the premise of, separation of powers. And I'm not condoning what the administration does, because I think that they're a bunch of clowns, actually. But these people, you know, with the advent of WMD after World War II and all these nuclear options and, you know, the attempts by or the insinuations by, the media of talking or the Western media insinuating Al-Qaeda wants to use nuclear devices or dirty bombs in the West, Paris, London, whatever. I sometimes am, I think, well, you know, if they want to do a little bit of listening in, maybe on just on a suspect idea that these guys might be dangerous, let's just listen in, who needs a warrant. I understand the courts exist for this kind of stuff, and I know that you were talking about earlier about the immediacy of conflict, but also the fact that these people, Al-Qaeda seems to be very fluid and more capable than we are. I mean, I don't know all the details. This guy's not going to, this individual's not going to speak to me. I was in a Special Forces unit 35 years ago, so I understand all the nature of confidentiality and, things you've done, I did, and, I don't talk about, I'll never talk about, except for things like that. But, I mean, I think these people are ruthless, and they are completely dedicated to doing as much damage to the West as possible. How they do it, when they do it, and it's obviously their decision. I mean, they are not going to go away until, I mean, I don't think we'll ever get rid of them. But it's just, you were talking about the government being, like a fascism and stuff like that, and like the Japanese. I mean, if they blow a couple of nuclear weapons in the West, I mean, all hell's going to break loose. I mean, who knows what'll happen? And I'm just very, very concerned about that. I'd like you to address that if possible.
Sure. Well, I respect your opinion, sir. And mm-hmm. and I also worry about Al-Qaeda. I mean, I wrote a book mm-hmm. which, I mean, one of the themes of the book is that our government didn't take terrorism seriously until it was too late.
Yeah.
So I really believe they're a problem.
Oh yeah, they really are.
But here and maybe I'm asking too much.
Yeah.
But you know what? I love this country, and I'm not. I have very high standards. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't think you have to lose nuance and subtlety in America when we're at war. And what I mean by that is we don't need to lose who we are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know the way the administration, I'm not saying you're doing this. As I said, I respect your service, and I know where you're coming from, and I admire it. I'm just saying, do we have to be in a situation where our government says to us, leave us alone, we're doing what's right,
mm-hmm.
we'll do what's right? Because they're not, the problem is their record sucks.
Excuse
me. You shouldn't have used. No, that's a terrible way to say it.
No, actually, you're right.
It's
I agree.
This isn't a minute. No, but I mean, this is an administration that comes to power in January of 2001 and demotes terrorism as one of our concerns.
Yeah.
It was more concerned about China and missile defense. And look, I mean, the record is clear. This is an administration that demoted the problem of terrorism. And I'm not saying that Richard Clark would have gotten right. In my book, I explain that he didn't quite get it right. But that's not the point is, at least he was focused on the problem. So it's an administration that was looking the wrong way in September 2001.
I agree.
So they get hit. Okay, they get hit. And then they do the right thing, which is to go after the bad guys in Afghanistan. But they don't finish the job. And then they go and they attack a country that, you know, I interviewed a lot of counterterrorism specialists to do my book. I didn't meet a single one who thought Iraq was a good idea. I haven't met a single one. So we have an administration that has not done a good job in counterterrorism. And now we're supposed to believe them?
Yeah. Well, this guy that I talked to he's been to Iraq 2 times, and he told me it's a joke. And I agree. I mean, I really agree with you. I'm just suspect of the fact that they're in charge, so somebody's got to do something, and that's what I don't know. I'm just as confused as you are, and I think we're being ruled by idiots, and just something, you know, just really.
Okay, well
me.
then what do we do as Americans when we begin to worry about our White House? Because we're Americans, and we believe in elections, and we believe in institutions, we hope that that executive is checked by another of our elected institutions. That's what we do, and that's what we did in the 1970s. And now your concern, and again, I'm with you here. Your concern is if we get too focused on the niceties, the bad guys are going to hit us again. And my concern is, I don't know how well this administration is actually protecting us against the bad guys. Look at the Department of Homeland Security. It is a mess. It is a mess. I mean, look at how it handled Katrina. Look at the revelations now about the way in which this whole department is constructed. What happens if these people that are telling us that they're protecting us are actually incompetent? What can protect us against these incompetents? What's there in our system? The only thing that's there is Congress. Because obviously we're going to go to another elected body. But that's my concern. This is an administration that is asking us to trust them, and yet there's so little reason to trust their instincts in counterterrorism.
I want to thank the caller very much for his comments, and hopefully you wouldn't mind if I go on, because I've got several others, and we're already past the midpoint. Let me ask you real quick, if I can.
Yeah.
In the controversy about the warrantless wiretaps, the White House has said that the problem with going through the FISA court is that it takes too long. And the critics, on the other hand, have said, now, wait a minute, you guys. The attorney general can authorize an emergency wiretap for 72 hours even before getting a warrant. So they say, so what's the problem? I mean, do you find any are you at all sympathetic with the White House that says the problem with the FISA court is to get the warrant, it takes too long?
The problem with the White House is that it's caught between a rock and a hard place. If you accept its description of this program and that it's focused, narrowly focused, involves only certain calls, then it actually fits under FISA. That's the problem. I believe that the program that they've undertaken is much broader, and that, in fact, FISA is sort of a 20th century, it involves 20th century technology and is not really, it needed to be updated. When the administration was crafting the Patriot Act, which, by the way, has provisions that the Clinton administration tried to pass in the mid-90s, but that right-wing Republicans didn't pass. That was an era when the House was very, very fearful of the FBI. Anyway, but the point is that during the period in 2001, when this administration was crafting the Patriot Act, it could have updated FISA. And it did to some extent. They did tweak FISA a bit, but they could have brought it up to deal with 21st century technology, and they didn't. So yes, I believe that FISA is inadequate to deal to allow for the kind of data mining, the kind of momentary interceptions that might be required as you basically go on a phishing expedition. And we probably need to go on a fishing expedition at times because a terrorist or a member of a terrorist cell in the United States could flip from one cell phone to another rather easily. All of that I can understand, but that's not the operation that the administration says that it's undertaking. The operation they're describing is one that fits very neatly within FISA. So they're trying to have it both ways. And that's why I want Congress to figure out what the devil's going on.
Okay. We're a little bit past the midpoint here. We've got some other callers we'll get right to. Our guest this morning is Timothy Naftali. He's Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia. His particular area of interest is the history of intelligence, and he's written on also the Cold War, on World War II, on espionage generally. He directs the Miller Center Presidential Recordings Program, where scholars are going over thousands of hours of telephone conversations and meetings secretly recorded in the White House by presidents from Roosevelt to Nixon. He also directs the Kremlin Decision-Making Project, where they are translating, editing, and publishing the international edition of some of the most secret materials of the Khrushchev era. He's author of the book Blind Spot, The Secret History of American Counterterrorism, published last year by Basic Books. Next caller up is also Urbana, and that's line number two. Hello.
Hello. Yes, we should know that the war in Iraq was a mistake because of the thousands of innocent civilians killed. But two observations I'd like you to comment on. One, first, it seems only natural that in a time of war that there will be increased security internally and externally. Secondly, I'm concerned with the rear guard action that the government and its resources must devote, the attention they must devote to contending with dissenters. For instance, like Clinton, if he could have devoted his time to world affairs instead of the affair with Monica Lewinsky and the depositions, the time and all his chief bureaucrats, it would have increased his chances of uncovering the 9/11 plot. Would you comment on those observations?
Well, certainly. A comment on the fact that in the summer of 1998, one very significant event occurs and one very political event occurs. The significant event is that Osama bin Laden on August 20th succeeds in attacking two American embassies in Africa. And the information that the United States government has on Osama bin Laden's responsibility is excellent, because with the help of the British, the United States has been intercepting his satellite telephone. Now, we didn't get advance warning. At least the 9/11 Commission didn't find that. It didn't get advance warning that these embassies would be bombed. But we were able to see his fingerprints immediately. And Clinton is faced with this opportunity and the necessary intelligence to go after bin Laden. And he decides to try to kill bin Laden. And he also tries to destroy one of bin Laden's installations in the Sudan, where bin Laden had been living until 1996. Well, he launches these cruise missiles. And this occurs at the same time that he is taking a deposition, he's giving a deposition, to the Star Inquiry. And this is the famous deposition about Monica Lewinsky. After the cruise missile attack, a number of people, responsible people, in the media and even in Congress, are saying that this is a wag-the-dog scenario, that Clinton has basically used military force to distract us from his troubles with Monica Lewinsky. This is an outrageous partisan attack on him, because, in fact, he was trying to kill bin Laden, and the world would be a much better place if he had killed bin Laden in 1998. Because the planes operation, which would ultimately become the 9/11 attack, the operation wasn't planned until 1999 and 2000. This would have changed history. But after this attack, and I interviewed some Clinton folks, and there's evidence in the 9/11 Commission report, after this attack, the Clinton administration got very wary of launching cruise missiles against Al-Qaeda, unless they were absolutely certain that bin Laden would be there, and that the target they had chosen was an al-Qaeda target, because some of them might have been civilian if the intelligence was bad. Well, they're wary because of this wag the dog issue, because in 1998 and 1999, the Lewinsky issue is dogging the president. And that is an unfortunate aspect to the Clinton attack or the Clinton sort of campaign against al-Qaeda. But let's be honest, what was really necessary was to clean out Afghanistan. And there was no one that I found in the Clinton administration who was arguing that we invade in Afghanistan, and I guess there was nobody in Congress who really wanted us to invade Afghanistan, and that was only possible after 9/11.
Well, let me just, and I hope again the callers will forgive me because I have several here, and again I want to get some more in there. Can indeed administrations, not just this one but others, make a sincere argument that says sometimes that public opinion gets in the way of their doing the right thing, the thing that actually is the thing that they should be doing?
Well, you know, here I'm going to be a little naive, but, you know, I spend some of my time teaching, and if I didn't believe that you could persuade people, I wouldn't be a teacher. I really believe it is incumbent upon presidents to lead and to use the White House as a bully pulpit. I would feel much, although I think Iraq is a mistake, I would feel better about Iraq if the president had said from the beginning, what we're doing here is this is a long-term approach to the Middle East. In order for those young men to stop giving themselves up to terrorist organizations, we have to give them a better life at home. And the way to do that is to spread democracy in the Middle East. And the way to do that is to knock over an easy country, one that's been bothersome to us, and it's one we can get at, and use them as a model for the rest of the Middle East. And I don't think it was a good idea. I think Woodrow Wilson taught us that 100 years ago. But at least that would have been honest. And then he could have rallied support for that. And that was really why they went in, not the weapons of mass destruction. But they were dishonest, and they didn't tell us why they were going in. And I think that really harms the legitimacy of a program. So my point is simply that the presidents ought to be shaping public opinion. I think you can be honest with the American people. You don't have to give away secrets. You'll note, for example, that Vice President Cheney in the Scooter Libby was his chief of staff. He was the man who has been indicted for giving away classified information in the Valerie Plame case. Mm-hmm. The vice president is now arguing that he has the right to declassify anything he wants. In other words, the White House is allowed to leak anything. No one else is allowed to leak intelligence. That's an unfortunate situation. That basically means the White House can say and do whatever it wishes. And I don't think that's healthy.
Yeah, it's a point that I think that some people feel it actually hasn't gotten the amount of attention that it should, is that not only has the administration claimed this power to classify anything that they want, they also are now apparently making the argument that they can declassify anything that they want, which means that then now that would automatically mean that doing something as is alleged, outing a CIA agent, they could just say, oh, well, just we decided to declassify that. So suddenly it now doesn't it's a non-crime anymore just because they say it is.
Well, that's why I'm a little concerned. I mean, I bring up the Roosevelt case because I want people to understand that this is not simply an issue about Republicans doing it. It's that we've learned that this is not a healthy way to deal with the challenges of wartime. We've learned this already, or we should have learned it already. And this is one of the previous callers was talking about how the administration always seems to deal retroactively with things. Mm-hmm. They do something, hoping that they're not going to get caught. Then they get caught, and they come up with a post facto rationalization for it. I think the torture issue is a very good example of it. The administration set out a position that the president has the right to use torture if he feels it's necessary to defend us. He may not. This administration says it didn't, but that it wants to reserve the right to do it if necessary. Well, Congress has said, no, you can't do that. And John McCain led with Chuck Hagel, really led this. But that's the administration's approach. It doesn't want to have any of its power limited in this war. And I just think that is absolutely inconsistent with the way in which Americans have been running their government from the start.
Let's talk with another caller here. Charleston, line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
We've been talking about how the Congress, that wing of the government may take a part in this. What about the courts? I'm wondering, I've heard at least one of the FISA judges had stated concern that she might have been giving out warrants that had been obtained through the use of tainted information, information that was obtained illegally. Are we going to be able to try anyone who we bring to court with us, or is the administration intending to simply call everyone a enemy combatant and imprison them without pressing any charges?
I think you will find that a lot of these issues, great question, that a lot of these issues weren't thought through. That when the administration was trying to figure out what to do with these people they captured in Afghanistan, they saw it as a short-term problem. Get these people, make sure they're under our control. We don't want the Red Cross messing up our chance to interrogate them. Find out exactly what they know. Help us win the war in Afghanistan. And then we'll worry about their disposition later. And I think I also believe that this NSA operation comes out of the same period, and it's an understandable reaction. Listen, we were taken by surprise. Al-Qaeda is a vicious organization. And so I don't think that they thought through the long-term consequences of their actions. In other words, they didn't think about future court cases that might be tainted because the information they're using was itself tainted.
I can't help but think that the whole Jose Padilla issue or situation is probably another outgrowth of this. They've come to realize that they can't take these cases to court.
Well, yes, you saw how they changed the indictment.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's he's no longer, there's no question, there's no, the issue of the dirty bomb has disappeared entirely. Yes, I'm sure that's what's happening in his case. What'll be interesting to see is the Lyman Ferris case. This is the truck driver from Ohio who was charged with planning to blow up the Brooklyn Bridge with a blowtorch or destroy it with a blowtorch. He pled guilty. Now he says that he didn't mean to plead guilty. I think actually because he pled guilty, he's still going to go to jail. But there are a number of cases where the plaintiffs are saying, or the defendants, I mean, are saying that the whole trial was based on information obtained illegally. And that's going to be a headache for the administration.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another Charleston caller. This is line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Excuse me. So far, I haven't heard anything really tangible or constructive in addressing this issue reforming the FISA court situation. I'm reminded historically of Abraham Lincoln's violating or suspending rights of habeas corpus during the Civil War and other unconstitutional actions, which he then basically got approval from or concurrence from the Congress within a short time after the fact. I haven't heard anything from you that suggests what this administration or a Democratic administration, for that matter, should be doing in terms of going to Congress and what he should ask for in terms of taking the specifically the FISA court situation, making changes to it to reflect the fact that you got to do data mining, you got to be able to intercept emails and the like that were probably never envisioned when that legislation was drafted. So I appreciate your comments.
No, that's sure. Fair. That's a fair point. And yes, indeed, in 1863, Lincoln went to Congress, and Congress passed the Habeas Corpus Act and basically legitimated what he had done. Well, for a couple of things that the administration or Congress could do. One is to lengthen the period for a retroactive warrant from 72 hours to something longer than that, which would mean that you'd still be in the FISA system, but it would give the NSA a little more time to determine whether a lead was legitimate or not. And if it was legitimate, then they would go forward with a warrant, and if it wasn't legitimate, they'd drop it. My sense, and again, a lot of what we think we know is very vague about this operation, but my sense is that the NSA is actually getting a lot of false positives, a lot of false hits, but these do involve momentary interception. and that somehow it's too complicated, too burdensome, too cumbersome, I mean, to arrange a brief for each of these false positives. And in order to avoid all of that legal dimension, the administration basically said, do what you have to do. And I think there'd be a way of lengthening wait times and the like to streamline the process so that it could be brought in under FISA. In terms of data mining, which isn't really necessarily listening in, it may be tapping in to streams of information briefly or even instant or momentarily, I suspect that Congress could pass a law and just set up some kind of privacy oversight board. You know, Admiral John Poindexter, who's not known as a great defender of privacy because of the Iran-Contra issue, actually thought very hard about privacy when he was working on the Total Information Analysis Project, Total Information Awareness Project, I mean, in 2002 and 2003. And one of the things he thought that when you did data mining, you could actually create a privacy appliance, which meant that you could follow streams of information and follow patterns without actually knowing the identity of the person behind the information. And if you had to, if you found that it was suspicious and needed to know the identity, then there'd be a way to sort of to determine that person's identity. But you would do it on select bases, and there'd be a footprint, there'd be a trail, so that this would work against arbitrary efforts to find out people's identities. And he worked on this privacy appliance. Then TIA was dismantled, and it doesn't look to me as if the National Security Agency has applied any privacy constraints on what they're doing. Again, this is something Congress has to ask and look into, and probably it's going to be something in executive session, but I'm hopeful that there are people in Congress who really care about ways in which you can maintain some privacy legally while still analyzing traffic and looking for suspicious patterns.
All right, we'll try and get at least one more caller. We'll go to Champaign next in line one. Hello.
Yes, thank you. I would say that the Bush administration is a completely cynical group that for whom politics trumps everything, and that certainly includes security. And as illustration of that, I would just point to during the 2004 campaign when we'd actually captured a member of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, I mean in Pakistan, and got him to turn and become a double agent, and was helping us to snare other members of the organization. The Bush administration decided that it would be politically good, because they were under attack for not making progress in capturing terrorists, to release that we had captured this guy, which blew his cover, which meant we could get no more, you know, use out of him. Further, I would say that you know, this whole notion that Iraq is, you know, some big project for the future of the Middle East to bring democracy is just a politically correct rationalization to cover for the real purpose, which was to bring it under, you know, the influence of our economic empire. We couldn't get Saddam to play ball with us and help us, you know, launder money for the way we did with Saudi Arabia. So we couldn't, you know, assassinate him. So we had to invade him, and that's something they wanted to do before they even, you know, got into office. And if you don't believe that, I would direct you to talk to John Perkins, who wrote The Confessions of an Economic Hitman, where he lays out how those kinds of things.
Yeah, let me. We got about 2 minutes. I give Professor Naftali opportunity to comment on what you have to say there. What do you think?
Well, both the Clinton and Bush administrations wanted to do something about Saddam. I'm not entirely sure that the way in which we've structured this follow-on or successor government sort of bears out the argument that we're there for economic reasons. I mean, if we were there for economic reasons, the thing to do would be to help the Kurds form an independent country, because they've got oil, and they would definitely be in our, absolutely, you know, in our they would be in our debt forever. And we're not really doing that because of the strategic concerns we have regarding what Turkey's response would be and perhaps what the Iranians would do. So I'm not sure. I mean, I can see the economic interests for the United States, but this has been a very, very expensive war. And it's been costly not only in sort of gold, lucre, but also costly politically. And I actually believe that the neocons, who provide a lot of the intellectual firepower behind this administration, had this much broader goal in mind. I said I don't share it. I think it's a mistake. I think historically we've seen that the United States has a very hard time transplanting our institutions, which took years to grow anyway, anywhere else. But I do believe that this is a highly ideological administration, and that its goals were less economic than, as I said, to promote Americanism overseas.
We are going to have to stop, with the promise that I'm sure we will be discussing these issues other days with other guests. But for the moment, we have to say our thanks to Timothy Naftali. He's Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia. He's the author of the book Blind Spot, The Secret History of American Counterterrorism, published by Basic Books last year. He's interested in the history of intelligence, has written about the Cold War and World War II and espionage. Professor Naftali, thank you very much.
Thank you, David. It's my pleasure.